Call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Today is April 13th, 2026. We're in the State Capitol, Senate Finance Room. Attending today's meeting, Chairman Olson, Chairman Stedman, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Hoffman, Senator Cronk, and myself. Senator Hoffman, we have a quorum to conduct business. We have two items on today's agenda. Senate Bill 154, Home Care Employment Standards Advisory Board. And the second item is a House Bill 173, Occupational Therapy Licensure Compact. Senate Bill 154, Home Care Employment Standards Advisory Board. This is the first hearing on this bill. I invite Senator Yount and his staff to introduce the bill to the Finance Committee. Good morning, Senator Yount. Please introduce yourself for the record and tell us why we need this bill.
Good morning, Senator Yount from the beautiful city of Wasilla, Alaska, here with you this morning. Thanks for having us. I'm going to go through the sponsor statement real quick, and I just realized that I left my reading glasses in my office, so bear with me here. But oh, look at Mike coming through. This might actually work. Holy mackerel. Thank you, sir. All right, Senate Bill 154, and as Mr. Hoffman asked, why we need it. Seniors are the fastest growing demographic in the state of Alaska and are living much longer lives now than in previous generations. The state's 85-plus population is expected to increase by 500% between 2022 and 2050, of which one-third will experience Alzheimer's and related dementia. The Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development predicts home care, a part of Alaska's continuum of care services for seniors and people with disabilities, to be one of the fastest growing and most in-demand occupations in the state. Alaska faces an acute shortage of direct care workers, particularly outside of population centers. The potential provider workforce demographic, those ages 18 through 64, is in decline. Furthermore, low pay and lack of benefits force many caregivers out of the profession and make recruitment and retention increasingly more difficult for agencies providing in-care, in-home care services. We need to create strong and long-lasting home care infrastructure in Alaska, which will expand access to quality, affordable home and community-based care for seniors and people with disabilities. People keep in their homes and out of costly facilities and bolster the creation of jobs. We also need to ensure the Medicaid funding for personal care services is wisely spent, with an adequate portion of the rate going to pay and benefits for direct home care workers in order to help address the workforce shortage. SB 154 accomplishes both of these objectives by establishing a home care employment standards advisory board that will investigate, advise, and develop recommendations on Medicaid rates and other policies to improve the wages, working conditions, and recruitment and retention of direct care workers. Secondly, requiring that agencies provide personal care services spend at least 70% of the total annual funding they receive from the Department for Personal Care Services on the pay and benefits of personal care assistants providing such services. And if you'd like, at this time, I could have my Chief of Staff, Ryan McKee, do a sectional analysis.
Before I go that, do members of the Senate Finance Committee have questions of Senator Yount at this time? Seeing none, we will go directly to invited testimony. We have one individual that says is in the audience, Alexis Radich. Please come forward, introduce yourself, and proceed with your invited testimony. We also have Tony Newman, the Director of the Division of Senior and Disability Services, for any questions that the Senate Finance members may have regarding this piece of legislation. Please identify yourself and proceed with your invited testimony.
Sure. Committee members, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Alexis Rodich. I'm the Alaska and Montana Director for the Alaska for the Caregivers Union, SCIU 775. Our union represents more than 60,000 direct care workers in Washington, Montana, and Alaska. We are deeply committed to a strong and sustainable system of long-term services and supports here in Alaska, and we believe that this bill is an important means to that end. As the Senator just referenced, our state has been experiencing a massive demographic shift that has been driving up demand for care and for higher skilled care in particular. Over the last decade, Alaska has had one of the fastest growing senior populations per capita in the country, a trend that is expected to continue at least over the next decade. Older Alaskans and Alaskans with disabilities are living even longer, which is great. However, with age comes higher acuity and more complex care needs. Many of the caregivers we work with, for example, have children with developmental disabilities who are living far longer than anybody might have anticipated in generations before. And yet they often ask, what happens if I'm no longer available to provide care? Similarly, Alzheimer's and other dementias are on the rise, which creates higher demand for paid and unpaid care services. Given these demographic changes, it is no surprise that the Department of Labor and Workforce Development predicts this to be one of the fastest growing and in-demand occupations in the state. But at the very same time, the number of potential direct care workers, that is working age adults, age 18 to 64, is in decline, going from 15 in 2018 to 7 in 2030. And this shortage is even more stark in rural and remote areas of the state. A higher concentration of older Alaskans live in Southeast Alaska and on the peninsula than any other part of the state. They've built lives, they have families, and they don't want to have to move to Anchorage or even out of state to get the care they need. They want to live in their own communities. And I know that nobody in this room wants that either. And we certainly don't want them forced to move into institutional or congregate care settings, which can cost the state hundreds of thousands of dollars more per person per year. This workforce crisis will only get worse and far more costly for the state unless we start taking steps now to ensure that we have a strong, well-trained, professional direct care workforce here in Alaska. So SB 154 helps in two ways. First, it makes sure that the state is maximizing the Medicaid personal care rate by creating what we might informally call a labor rate for personal care services. That is a percent of the Medicaid rate that agencies receive for personal care services that must go to direct pay and benefits for direct care workers. In a state like Alaska, where almost all personal care services are provided through a consumer-directed agency with choice model, far less of the Medicaid rate needs to go to overhead agency overhead because the agency has far fewer responsibilities than a traditional agency model. It is the client, the person receiving care, and not the agency that is responsible for recruitment, scheduling, hiring, et cetera. So it's fair that a substantial amount of the rate should go to direct care services and not to agency overhead. In the case of this bill, that's 70% initially and 80% by 2029. SB 154 would also create much more transparency around how the Medicaid personal care rate is being used. Over the past few years, caregiver after caregiver has flown here to Juneau, met with many of you guys and other members of the Senate, called into public testimony to share how the low Medicaid rate keeps their pay low and makes it impossible for them to make ends meet without picking up extra jobs, juggling bills, going into debt. This body listened and responded with multiple rate increases, two of which expressed the legislative intent that the rate go to increasing pay. And some caregivers did get pay increases, some as many as $2 to $4 an hour, which is a huge relief if you're only making $16 an hour, but many more did not. And really, no one knows how the rate increases were used because it does not appear that this information is collected or analyzed systematically. This was echoed in the findings of a comprehensive rate study commissioned by the Department of Health and conducted by Guidehouse. This study found that indirect costs, that is the administrative overhead, program support, and other non-direct care costs, make up a larger share of total long-term services and supports costs in Alaska than is typical in other states, even accounting for the general higher cost of living and operational costs. And the report did not find a reasonable justification for that cost other than possibly business inefficiency. So more transparency, such as the requirements in this bill, will not only help enforce the labor rate, it also gives the department, the Office of Reviews, and the legislature more information with which to assess how the rate is currently being used. The second way the SB 154 strengthens the long-term care workforce is that it creates a workforce standards advisory board. This board, modeled in part after similar entities in Nevada and Washington, brings together the stakeholders most impacted by the care system, that is, providers, caregivers, people receiving care in the Department of Health, together to identify and plan for longer-term workforce needs, assess whether the rates are adequate to meet those needs, and make rate recommendations to the Department of Health as part of the department's own rate-setting process. Late summer, early fall of every year, we meet with a bunch of caregivers from around the state and talk about what to prioritize in Juneau for the next year. And every year, topics like training, improved possibility of health insurance, having their clients get adequate hours, these things come up year after year. But initiatives like this take time in future planning. A board like the one proposed in this bill creates a vehicle for this group of stakeholders, all of whom have unique and invaluable expertise on the care system in our state, to work together to identify priorities, recommend solutions, and assess whether we are adequately resourced or need to plan ahead. The demographic changes I referenced earlier are already underway, and the caregiver shortage is already sorely felt. We've heard wrenching stories of caregivers needing to move their loved ones to Anchorage in order to get their care needs met, or others having to quit their job in order to provide unpaid care to a loved one who would otherwise go without. SB 154 is an opportunity to make a different choice for Alaska, one that will be far less costly for the state in the long term and for Alaskans who need care now or down the road. Thank you.
Thank you, Alexis. Do members of the Senate Finance Committee have questions? Seeing none, we will go to public hearing. We'll open the public hearing. Is there anyone online? Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on this legislation? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 154 has one fiscal note from the Department of Health, Senior and Disability Services Administration. It shows an FY27 need for $206,600 of UGF in one full-time position. It also notes that there will be some new regulations needed. In FY28, that increases by one additional position to an ongoing cost of $378.9, which levels out after some startup costs at $375.9.
Thank you. There are changes in federal policy. Is Tony Newman in the audience? Please come forward.
Sure.
Yeah. Go ahead. Mr. Newman, can you explain the changes in federal policy that might affect this fiscal note?
Thank you. Yes, Senator Hoffman, Mr. Chair. My name is Tony Newman. I'm the Director of the Division of Senior and Disability Services at the Alaska Department of Health. And the federal landscape around the requirements for access regarding personal care are changing. A year ago, the department would have said that the board that is proposed to be formed under this bill would satisfy federal requirements. However, several pieces of the proposed rulemaking at the federal level have been officially rescinded, and national advocacy groups have been reporting that states should expect proposed federal requirements to be withdrawn the next month or two. At this time, the department cannot say whether this board would satisfy a federal requirement.
Questions of Mr. Newman, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if the director could give us maybe a little better sense of what kind of requirements are we talking about here. That they exist or don't exist is good to know, but maybe a little more about what they are or aren't.
Mr. Newman.
Thank you, through the chair. Senator Keel, a few years ago, the federal government introduced a new federal rule called the Ensuring Access to Medicaid Rule. It's a sprawling federal rule with a number of requirements of states, one of which was that that states establish a advisory group related to personal care, homemaker services, examining their wages, providing reporting on those sorts of things. That's why that's why the division was interested in this bill, because it appeared that this bill was going to help us satisfy that federal requirement. A few months ago, we received word that the federal requirements were going to be lifted. So that's why I report that we're uncertain what the status of the federal requirement will be moving forward into the future.
Senator Keel.
Thank you. So it doesn't sound like it would hurt federal compliance. It just may not be strictly required for federal compliance. Is that what I'm...
Through the chair, Senator Keel, correct.
Thanks. And then if I may...
Senator Keel.
So, Mr. Newman, Director, the fiscal note talks about two positions. It is not a regulating board. So when I think about writing a report, one a year, I don't think about two permanent full-time positions. Can you talk to us a little bit more about the interaction between what the bill requires, what the feds may or may not require, and two full-time jobs worth of work?
Mr. Newman.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, certainly. So two positions. We roughly decided we needed one position to manage the functions of the advisory group, of the advisory board, establishing meetings, managing the participants of the board. But what the bill would require is extensively more reporting requirements than are currently required. It would require providers to provide wage information, cost information that they're currently not required to provide. So there would be quite a bit of management of that information. We would need regulations as well, because currently providers aren't compelled to provide that information to us. So we would want regulations to establish the requirement that they provide that information to us.
Senator Keel.
On a slightly different topic,
yes.
If I may. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director, the other question I had is, I think the invited testifier talked about getting the maximum benefit out of federal programs and it changing how the payments that go to the providing organizations get divvied up. Potential impacts on federal rates that come to Alaska and state match, up, down, no change at all, over the long term with this board.
Mr. Newman.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, when we saw that there were federal requirements around the establishment of this board and that around the reporting requirements, wage reporting requirements, we assumed that through the fiscal note we would be able to match that funding with federal match for the two positions that we've got in the fiscal note. Without the federal requirement, we don't believe there would be a federal match available to us. So that's why we've moved the fiscal note from a 50-50 federal state rate match participation to strictly general fund.
Mr. Keel.
For the services themselves, any change anticipated?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, no.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Comments, Senator Young?
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair to the body. the changes at the federal level or potential changes did just come to us, and so those are something we're talking about and making adjustments for. Right now, the need for this really is just based on the future growth of senior populations and then the large amount of agency overhead and administrative money that's being used up by this program that's not really finding a home where it needs to be. So there seems to be a lot of waste in this area, in my opinion, and I do think an advisory board would help substantially get that under control. So thank you, sir.
Thank you, Senator Young. Do you have any closing comments before we set this bill aside, Senator Young? With that, we'll set this bill aside and be sure to see it at a future time before the end of session. That brings us to the second item on today's finance agenda, which is House Bill 173, Occupational Therapy Licensure Compact. This is the first hearing on this bill. I invite Representative Jimmy and and staff to the table to introduce the bill to the Senate Finance Committee. Representative Jimmy, please identify yourself for the record and enlighten us on what the bill does.
Good morning, committee. Unangyugo, Representative Jimmy from District 38. Today I'd like to introduce House Bill 173, the establishing of the Occupational Therapy Licensure Compact. This is an important legislation matter because not only from personal experience where my daughters had to have physical therapy growing up and we've missed her appointment because of weather and we weren't able to reschedule for another 6 months. And if we missed that, then we'd have to wait another 4 months. And it's becoming common talk, especially in rural, when we have to fly to a hub, to our Bethel hub, for an appointment, and people talk about missing their appointments due to weather. That's a huge factor. It's very important to provide services for anyone to get these services from rehabilitation, from surgery, from an injury, to be properly healed. Today, we also have testifiers. One is Brian Oswald with the Alaska Occupational Therapy Association. The other is Carl Sims with the National Center for Interstate Compacts as a Council of State Government. Chuck Wilmer with the American Occupational Therapy Association is also online for question. My staff, now Keenan Miller, will do a brief overview of House Bill 173 and the sectional analysis if it is the will of the committee.
We will forego that and go directly to public testimony. But before we go to public testimony, do members of the Senate Finance Committee have questions of Representative Jimmy at this time? Seeing none, we will go to invited testimony. Brian Oswald with the Alaska Occupational Therapy Association, please identify yourself and proceed with the invited testimony at this time.
Hi, thank you. Yes, my name is Brianne Oswald, and I'm an occupational therapist and the outgoing president of the Alaska Occupational Therapy Association, which represents over 170 occupational therapists and occupational therapy assistants in the state of Alaska. We are in support of House Bill 173, which supports bringing quality care and continuity to Alaskans. We only have one occupational therapy program in the state that brings about 12 students every year that does not keep up with the titration rate of people retiring or leaving state. So we rely on people coming out of state to come and practice and serve Alaskans. I myself came from out of state and it took almost 3 months for me to get a license to practice in the state. And the OT bill will help individuals who come to the state get a license so it doesn't delay or dissuade them from coming to practice. And I've been here for 5 years now and bought a house and continue on. So we want people to come to the state, we want them to practice, and we want to serve Alaskans without 3 months, 4 months, 5 months wait. We want to get people in and we want to get them practicing so that we can treat Alaskans and get them back to their home communities. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Oswald. We will go to Carl Sims with the Council of State Governments. Mr. Sims, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your invited testimony.
Thank you, Chair Hoffman. Carl Sims with the Council of State Government, National Center for Interstate Compacts, for the record. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on House Bill 173. I'll keep my remarks brief and be primarily here for questions that the committee might have. I did want to point out that the Occupational Therapy Compact is similar in form and function to other compacts, so there are varying models, but it's closely akin to the Physical Therapy Compact, of which Alaska is currently a member of, whereby the compact establishes uniform criteria for practitioners to use the compact and practice in other compact member states in a streamlined manner. It's also voluntary for the practitioner to use and preserve other pathways to licensure that a state may have. So an example of uniform criteria is that A practitioner must have an unencumbered license and have the completion of a background check in order to participate in the compact. The compact also preserves the sovereignty of states when it comes to the practice of occupational therapy. So, for example, any practitioner using the compact and providing services in the state of Alaska, whether that's through telehealth or in the state, would have to abide by the scope of practice of Alaska. So that's where the patient's located. If the patient's in Alaska, that's where the scope of practice follows. And the state could also choose, as other compact member states could, to implement a jurisprudence exam, an exam with the laws and regulations for a practitioner to complete before they're issued an authorization to practice through the compact. Lastly, I'll note that from a public protection standpoint, that states retain their right to discipline a practitioner who is authorized to provide services in their state and using their own laws and regulations. So they're able to, just if they would take action or other means to a license, they could also do so through a privilege of practice through the compact. The compact currently has 33 member states and is operational. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm glad to answer your questions if any might have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sims. I don't see any questions at this time. We'll go ahead and open the public hearing. Is there anybody online that would like to testify at this time? We have Tori Dougherty, a member of the Alaska State Physical Therapy and Occupational Therapy Board. Tori, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Through the chair, thank you, chair and committee members, for allowing me to speak today. For the record, my name is Tori Dougherty, and I am an occupational therapist. I'm available for technical questions today on behalf of the State Physical Therapy and Occupational Therapy Board, as I am a member and secretary of this board. This board is our state's licensing board for OTs and OTAs, as well as PTs and PTAs. The board creates regulations based on statute to protect public safety and carry out the legislative intent. The board reviews and approves applications for PT and OT licensure. The PT compact has already been enacted as Section 884188, and Alaska has begun granting PT compact privileges. HB 173 has very similar requirements to the PT compact in Section 884188. And so the board has already navigated many of the necessary procedural changes that would be needed if the OT compact is adopted in Alaska. The board has noticed reductions in administrative burden and improved timeframes for PTs to enter the workforce in Alaska as a result of the PT compact, which is similar to the OT compact. And then I'm available for technical questions today if needed. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Was it Dougherty?
Yeah, you got it.
Thank you. Ms. Dougherty, so we have a little natural experiment. Maybe you can help us. How long is it taking now for someone with a license in another state to get approved to practice in Alaska as a PT? And how long is it taking to get approved to practice as an OT?
That's a great question. Our average is about 4 weeks. Through the chair, this is Dougherty for the record. Our average is about 4 weeks. It does vary person to person. Sometimes we'll ask somebody for feedback, and they're just slow to get back to us if we need additional documentation. On the license application, we do ask them to identify if they have a job lined up. And then if they tell us that they do have patients waiting on them to be seen, we try to speed things up for them, too, as best as we can. I was sitting in on a presentation by the OT Compact. There's the Occupational Therapy Compact Commission in September, and they were explaining that their turnaround rate to get an OT privilege is 3 to 4 minutes. So we're jumping from 4 weeks to 3 minutes if we were to enact the OT Compact. And that just really speeds up access to patient care. For example, my coworker a couple months ago broke her ankle, and she was off work for 1 month. So we weren't able to fill her position with a travel therapist because she was off for a month and we didn't have someone lined up ready to be licensed. Versus if we had had her ready to go or had access to privilege, we probably could have filled her position in much more quickly and actually had those patients covered. As it was, I saw two of her patients and the rest of her patients just were not treated.
McKeel.
Thank you. Just for clarity, right now, if you want to bring a physical therapist to Alaska, 4 minutes.
Physical therapist? physical therapy turnaround time, I'm not precisely clear on that. Occupational therapy time is 4 minutes.
Or hypothetically would be.
Yeah, that's true. Like, if so, in other states that are not our state, it is 3 to 4 minutes. Because they've been fully vetted prior to submitting their license application for privilege.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder, and if you're not the person to answer, I think we've got someone from the department here. Can you talk to us about the cost difference and who pays, both for initial licensure and then when there's a complaint?
Yeah, through the chair, this is Daugherty for the record. I can speak to part of this question, and then Director Sylvan-Robb's present too. So with the PT compact right now, the PTs are being charged the same fees for their privilege as they would be if they were licensed directly in the state. So it's the same process. That doesn't include any amount of money that is removed from the application process. They pay directly to the PT compact to process the PT compact. So essentially, we're bringing in the same revenue because the therapist is paying the same fees as everybody else. And then in terms of the cost of, like, a complaint, I'd like to defer to Director Robb.
Can the director come forward and answer the second part of the question for Senator Keel? Please identify yourself, and do you need the question repeated?
Mr. Chair, I think I have the question. For the record, Sylvan Robb, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. Through the chair to Senator Keel, sir, I believe your question was how will investigations be paid for? Is that correct?
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Chairman, especially the comparison to with and without the compact.
Through the chair to Senator Keel, thank you for clarifying that. This compact is structured with it's the compact style where somebody has a license in their home state, and then when they want to practice in another state, they apply to the compact for practice to privilege, privilege to practice in those other states. And in each of the states where they apply for that, they are charged a fee by the compact, and then each state may also set a fee for obtaining that privilege. With the physical therapy compact that's live already, cost for the practice privilege is the same as the cost of a license, so that to ensure that in the case there were any investigations, that those would be shared equally because those are reflected in the cost of license fees.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so then if someone with an Alaska license is practicing outside, which state foots the bill for an investigation of a complaint, and how does that differ if it's someone with an Alaska privilege who faces a complaint from an Alaskan patient?
Through the chair to Senator Keel. So in the case where you have somebody who's here on a practice privilege, if the incident occurred in Alaska, so they were treating a patient in Alaska, regardless of whether that individual themselves was located in Alaska, that would be investigated by the division, and those costs would be borne by both licensees, again, as well as the compact members, because they have paid the same cost. Then their home state, so whichever state they reside in, who issued their actual license, not a privilege to practice, could also take action against the license. And it would be up to that state to determine if they wish to conduct their own investigation or just receive information from Alaska based on the investigation we conducted. In the flip side, where you have somebody who is an Alaska licensee who is operating on a practice privilege in another state, it would operate the way it does for the other states. So if somebody with an Alaska license who gets a practice privilege, say in Washington State, had a complaint against them in Washington State, Washington State would investigate that complaint, and then Washington State can decide whether they want to take action against that practice privilege or not. That would be cost borne by them. Then Alaska would be notified if there was action taken against that practice privilege, and then the board here, again, could conduct their own investigation on top of what Washington had done or look at the information from Washington and determine how to move forward with that person's license.
Senator Keel.
Did that answer all your questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So then the follow-up would be when you have someone who retains a home state license and has had action against their privilege to practice in other compact states, and they put in for their four-minute approval to come to Alaska, they still have their home state license. What do we do?
Were you asking the question?
Perhaps to the chair of the board, but whoever wants to answer, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, and I apologize. It didn't seem like you had quite gotten to the end of your question, but through the chair to Senator Keel, the reason, and several people may be familiar that, you know, it takes a little while to stand up these compacts. So the physical therapy compact had an effective date of July 1. It didn't actually become effective until May 1 of the following year. And that is because the integral part of compacts and what makes them safe is that there's this data system in the background that allows us to be sure that we know who has a practice privilege or who is authorized to practice in other states, as well as the ability to see any disciplinary information. It is worth noting that no state has seen an increase in their investigation costs after joining compacts, and no state has seen there are multiple compacts where there have been no investigations, period, for those compacts. And part of that is because many, almost all of the compacts require higher standards than what we have in Alaska to just get a straight Alaska license to practice. So the education, experience, passage of exams are all the same, but that threshold for no discipline, no criminal background, all of those things are higher for the compacts. And so you kind of have all these squeaky clean people who are participating in those compacts, and so therefore you see far fewer investigations.
Senator Keel.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I may have misunderstood some of the earlier testimony about how this works. I guess I'll just look at the map and pick random states. But if somebody's got a North Dakota license, and at some point Louisiana said, okay, fine, but not here, North Dakota didn't act against their license. They have lost a practice privilege somewhere, but they've still got their home state license. They put into Alaska to get a practice privilege here. How's that work? We say yes. We say no. We look at it case by case.
Through the chair to Senator Keel, so that is governed by the compact. So in your case, if the person is from North Dakota and they had a practice privilege in Louisiana, and I don't have the map in front of me, I'm going to assume those are both compact states. In our example, they can be. If they lose their practice privilege in Louisiana, they lose their practice privilege in every state. So if you do something that causes one state to say you are not welcome here, then you lose that practice privilege. The only entity that can impact your actual license is your home state. But they are required under the terms of the compact to take action against that and to consider whatever happened in Louisiana to lead to that loss of practice privilege in the same way as if it had happened in North Dakota. So it's ensuring that we don't have folks who are having complaints against them who are violating a scope of practice practicing. That's certainly not the intent of the compacts. And so in your example, could that person then come to Alaska? And I may defer to a lifeline if I may, Mr. Chair, but typically if you lose that practice privilege opportunity, and so you've lost it in Louisiana, generally you have to wait 2 years until whatever the issue was has been resolved. So, for example, if you were placed on probation as a result of whatever that issue was, then you need to serve your probation, wait a period of time, at which point you could then reapply for privileges to practice. But if I may, Mr. Chair, I believe Deputy Director Glenn Saviors is online, and she is the compact queen. We, with nine compacts in front of the legislature, I want to make sure that I'm not muddling my details from one compact to another.
Glenn Saviors, are you online?
Yes, sir, I am.
Please.
Good morning, chairs and member of the committee. This is Glenn Saviors, Deputy Director of the Corporation Business and Professional Licensing. So the compact language, what it says is that, and it is on page 9, line 20, if you want to take a look, what it says is a licensee's compact privilege in a remote state is moved. The individual may lose the compact privilege in any other remote state until that two-year period. And so I actually apologize, but I would defer to Mr. Sims to tell us when that may is a shall, if what the rule is on that right now.
Senator Keel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess that's the heart of the question. If it's really a may and it's not a shall, what do we do?
Ms. Saviors?
For the record, this is Glenn Saviors. So, Senator Keel, through the chair, the way that this would work is it would be based on the rules set by the Compact Commission. And so the Compact Commission is made up of all of the member states. And so it's those member states that decide generally what it means when you see a may, and this is speaking in general for compacts, is that it's up to the other remote states. So the compact allows for joint investigations and for states to take action based on other remote states' actions, right? So if we see in Louisiana something occurred that Alaska doesn't like, we can say, hey, based on that, your compact privilege is also suspended here. That's the state's choice. That's generally what it means with the may. However, the Compact Commission also could have made a rule on this, and so I would just, I would like to check with Mr. Sims. I believe he's on the line with the Council of State Governments to see if there's any such rule, or otherwise if it is up to each remote state whether they want to take action if a different remote state has taken action.
Carl Sims, are you still online?
I am Chair Hoffman. Thank you for the question. So the way it currently works, and to my up-to-date understanding, barring the future commission rule, is that if a compact privilege were to be revoked by a compact member state, that information is then communicated to the other compact member states so they can see, okay, this action was taken, here's the information behind that, so that each member state can decide, well, do we want to also take action against the privilege that we have granted? The answer may be yes, the answer may be no, based on each of those states' laws and regulations. So it's up to each state about whether, when they've already granted the privilege, whether they may want to revoke it. Now, that's different, though, than the same practitioner. If they want to get a new privilege from another compact member that they don't currently have, those states haven't had a chance to really vet that information like the other states who currently have given a privilege to that person. So what the compact says is that 2 years must have elapsed from the date of the completion of that adverse action or having that encumbrance against the privilege. After 2 years have elapsed since the completion of that, and then they meet all other criteria for the compact, then they may apply for a new compact privilege in another state.
Thank you, Mr. Sims. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sims, there was a phrase that caught my ear. You said, barring future commission decision. So that answer is subject to change?
To the chair, Senator Keel, to clarify that statement, the compact language as it currently is written cannot be amended by the commissioner rule. To clarify, what I'm speaking of would be more of a process base, but what I was speaking to as far as what compact member states are authorized to do and the conditions by which a practitioner may have their privilege revoked, the authority for a compact member state to do that, and then that two-year criteria, that cannot be changed by the commission. So to clarify my statement there, I will speak to more of the process of the exact process and mechanics behind how that would be carried out.
Thank you, Mr. Sims. We will go on. Senator Keel, there are two other testifiers.
Co-chair Hoffman,
yes.
I believe Mrs. Daugherty has a little bit more to add to the conversation.
Through the chair, for the record, this is Tori Daugherty. It's like really important to note too that this is better communication between states about disciplinary action than we currently have in place at this time. Right now, because somebody can still be licensed in more than one state. Someone could be licensed in Alaska and also in Washington. If they were to commit a bad act in Washington State, then we would have to trust Washington State to report that act to the other states in which they're licensed and to the National Provider Data Bank. We don't have a central place for OT disciplinary action reporting. Physical therapy does. They have it's FSBPT, but like any time a physical therapist has disciplinary action, it gets reported to a central place and that gets filtered out to everybody. OT does not have that. So even when we're asking someone, like, where are you licensed, we are relying on their honesty when they answer. We don't have a national centralized list of where they're licensed. So someone might tell us, I'm licensed in Washington, Oregon, California, and then they may fail to admit that they were licensed in Arizona. And so when we go to verify someone's license, Washington, Oregon, California, everything looks good, that's all they told us about, and we have to take them at their word. But we would never know that they also had another disciplinary action in a different state that they did not report. And with the OT Compact Commission, there's a centralized place where everything will be reported to. And then from there, the OT Compact Commission would disseminate that information out to wherever this person holds their other licenses and privileges. So it gives us a deeper layer of safety net when there is a bad actor, because it gives us one more way to know what happened in that other state, where right now we just may not be aware of it in reality.
Thank you, Mr. Daugherty. We will go to Click One, where we'll hear from Maggie Hutch. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much. I'm Maggie Hutch. I live in Click One, Alaska, and I am both a business owner throughout Southeast that maintains an open call for occupational therapists and occupational therapy assistants. Nationwide, there's currently 67% of employers that are having trouble filling occupational therapy positions, but I also am a parent of a disabled teenager in a very rural place such as Click One, who can speak to the limited service provision in rural schools and rural communities. So I encourage the advancement of this bill to improve access to all Alaskans while also maintaining the Alaska Licensing Board's existing ability to protect the public. I do want to commend the Licensing Board's improvement on turnaround time for new licensees. I've been operating my practice for about 20 years in Alaska, and it was several months and a huge cost barrier for me as a business owner and an employer within the state of Alaska, and they have shortened that turnaround time for new licensees. But there is a hidden cost to unfilled positions within our schools and within our communities and clinics, and that really, I think, is the mental health of both the clinicians who are short-staffed and maintaining high caseloads, and a lot of our exiting clinicians are doing so because they are burning out, because they're working to try to meet the community's needs when we have staffing shortages, but also the mental health of our Alaskans who are waiting for services. Right now in Juneau, I've got the wait list about a year and a half out for pediatric services, and it's very hard for me to meet these needs. I also, as an employer, don't view the compact as a replacement for Alaska licensure. If I have somebody that's practicing in Alaska, it would be my expectation as their employer that they would still pursue an Alaska license. But this does, I think, improve access to care. The rural nature of our state, I think any initial cost to establish the infrastructure required to participate in the compact would quickly pay for itself in the cost savings. Occupational therapy is one of the only rehab professions that's proven to reduce hospital readmission, and in our rural parts of the state, that becomes a much more expensive process. So I encourage the advancement of this bill to increase services to the state of Alaska and all of its residents, as well as to help employers put these folks to work safely and quickly.
Thank you for that testimony. Is there anyone else online that wants to testify? Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 173. If not, we'll close the public hearing. Senator Keogh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is one fiscal note for House Bill 73, the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development's Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing gives the bill a zero fiscal note, notes they will need to make regulation changes.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Representative Jimmy, do you have any closing comments before we set this bill aside for further consideration?
Jim Kuya Kamjitam Hpiji Una Magnitu Knuluji Una House Block 173 Yaka Kuya Kamjitak Nakpak Jali Su Ukut. Mr. Mr. Sims, Mrs. Oswald, Mr. Wilmer, and Hpiji, thank you all for taking the time to allow me to present House Bill 173 today and taking the time.
Thank you, Representative Jimmy. We will set this bill aside and brief at ease. Call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. There's a possibility that we might have the capital budget this afternoon for introduction, so we will potentially have a meeting at 1:30 tomorrow morning. If we don't have that meeting, we'll be at 9 a.m. We have two pieces of legislation for tomorrow's agenda, HB 17, Disabled Veterans, and HB 48, Civil Legal Services Fund. Anything else to come before the committee? None, we are adjourned.